Hi, everyone. I'm Brent Hamacek, and welcome to the Zelenko Report. This week, we have a couple of very interesting guests for you, and we hope you'll enjoy them. First, we'll be joined by Frank Zelenko, the late Dr. Vladimir Zelenko's brother, and he's going to share with us some stories, personal stories, about his brother and what he was like and the impact that he had on him. In the second part of the show, we'll be joined by author and celebrity Naomi Wolf, who will talk about her initiatives to reach out to young people and get them to better communicate with one another. Of course, we do this show each week because the Zelenko Foundation has been proud to support the Common Ground Campus program that brings civil dialogue to college and high school campuses across the country. So I hope you'll join us for what I think will be a very interesting show.
Satellite phones have been wiped out globally because of the supply chain collapse and war in Europe. But a truly amazing new option has emerged, the BiviStick, which allows you to send and receive text messages using almost any mobile device without relying on cell towers at all. In a world where war, riots, or a power grid failure can happen literally at any time, the BiviStick and its two-way satellite messaging gives you the power to reach loved ones, to send emergency messages or request a rescue. And to use this device, you do not have to register your name and you don't need to turn on location services or reveal your geographic location. The battery life is several days in duration and you can easily recharge it using a small portable power bank. There are only about 20,000 BiviSticks that will be available in America this year. Get yours now while they're still available at SAT123.com. That's SAT123.com. Your own government has the power to activate a kill switch on all telecommunications, instantly shutting down all private phone calls and texts. An EMP weapon or solar flare can achieve the same result. Rolling blackouts or permanent power outages will also take out the power supply to cell tower antennas, rendering mobile devices all but useless. During these emergencies, how do you stay in touch with the important people in your life anywhere on the planet? The answer is the BiviStick at SAT123.com. The BiviStick is a two-way satellite text messaging device that uses a satellite constellation, not cell towers, to send and receive text messages. It works anywhere on planet Earth, including in war zones or blackout areas. In unpredictable times, the BiviStick helps you stay connected when it matters most. Visit SAT123.com to get one while they're still available.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Zelenko Report. Your host, Brent Hamacek, here. And this is special, so we're going to do something today that's a real treat. I have here with me Frank Zelenko, who is Zev's brother, still is his brother. I shouldn't say was. He'll always be his brother. But I got to know Frank during the process of writing Zev's book. He sat with us in the Florida apartment where we worked on interviews, and I had a chance to get to know him. And he's a remarkable man, a kind man, and a genuine man. And I thought, you know, in Zev's book, there's part of it that is in the front half of the book that shares a little bit about Zev's autobiographical journey before the pandemic and gives people a sense of his life and who he was. And for those who haven't read the book yet, what we tried to focus on with Zev were what we called inflection points. And those were moments in his life where he felt like things happened that altered the direction of his life. So Zev had already written an autobiography of his life up until 2018. So we didn't want to duplicate the work. We thought we would just focus on those key moments. But here to focus on any moment that he would like to focus upon is Zev's brother, Frank Zelenko. So Frank, thanks so much for being a guest today. I really appreciate it. It's a total privilege to have you on.
It's a privilege to be on. Thank you so much, Brent.
So let's have a little bit of fun. This is nice. You know, we talk a lot about on this show, on the show I host, of issues that are, you know, impacting and dividing young people and causing trouble and all of that sort of thing. So now we get to just let's start with young people, and let's start with the young Zelenko brothers, and give us a sense of what it was like growing up with your brother. Share a fun story, share whatever you want, but talk about.
Are you sure? We were, you know, I wouldn't say we got along. I'd do anything to not get along, to continue not getting along with him, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, there could be some funny stories. There's a time that I scared him very badly. There's too many of those occurrences. I'm not sure exactly where to start.
So, well, let me help you. What was Zev like as a kid? I mean, as a young person, everybody came to know him. It's kind of like nobody other than his patients really knew who he was and his family up until the pandemic. And then the whole world got to see him and they got to know bits and pieces. But what was he like as a kid?
He was a huge nerd. Growing up, and I mean that in the best way. You know, he was always a good student. You know, photographic memory, basically, or nearly so. And you know, he was very driven and dedicated to the things that he took an interest in. That's you know, as a kid, really as an adult as well, I guess. You know, obviously his priorities changed when he became a man of faith. You know, that came to us a little bit later. We weren't brought up right. in a religious family. My parents had brought us over. Well, I was born in the United States, but he was very little when he came over. And my parents came from a family that are Soviet immigrants, and you know, who were basically secular people. We didn't have that much information about our own historical culture, because of the way the Soviet Union was. But, you know, in my teenage years and in his early 20s, we both kind of took an interest in the Jewish culture, like where we came from, became observant eventually. So, you know, all of the things that, all that energy that he had, you know, with his interests growing up before that point, and the energy that he used to achieve what he did, you know, it kind of, he tried to channel that, and I think he did it successfully. He channeled it to, you know, to his service of God.
Yeah. So our viewers can get a sense. What's the age difference between you and Zev?
So he is 7.5 years older.
That half a year, folks, is important, because a lot.
When I say 8 years, my mom always corrects me, and she says 7.5. I said 7.5 years. So I didn't want to have a. I don't want to get in trouble again.
We have a rule on this show that nobody gets in trouble with mom. That's strictly forbidden. I'm curious. You mentioned the religious thing, and I wanted to ask you about it. We point that out in the book. Zev talks about how life had been somewhat secular, and how your family, having seen you know, before you were born, but your family lineage having seen the ravages of the Holocaust and growing up and living. Them living in the Soviet Union and in Ukraine, that where religion was sometimes at best tolerated and more often persecuted, that they weren't, it just wasn't a religious family. I'm wondering if you can share your brother's conversion What that was like. I mean, what you experienced through experiencing what he was experiencing, to definitely overuse a word too much in video here.
Well, you know, I can only really speak for myself as to why, like, what my reasons were. Mm-hmm. It was very odd, actually. It was happening with both of us simultaneously, but not in the same time and without knowledge of each other. That's a very odd, I mean, for some people that might not be strange, but, you know, he was already in college and, unbeknownst to me, was having his own, and we weren't telling each other about it. So the fact, you know, we were both basically becoming religious without realizing the other person was going, and for me, was almost impossible to believe that that was happening to him, because he, you know, he liked to call himself an atheist before. I knew he wasn't, and, you know, but, you know, he thought of himself that way for a while. I think it was more of an emotional reaction than something that he, you know, felt rationally or took upon himself as a philosophy. But that's what he would call himself until he took a trip to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And he met
where so many conversions happen.
Yeah. You know, technically, I think he would say we don't call it a conversion. We call it to translate the word from the Hebrew. The Hebrew word is teshuvah. Teshuvah just means to return, or to kind of like, you know, like it's difficult to translate. Like if you smashed a vase, to bring all the pieces back together, just to return to your original form. The idea of conversion exists, but since we were born Jewish in a sense, so we didn't technically need conversion, but the idea, it's called return. Yeah. So he returned, you know, he felt that, you know, the desire to do so after his experience in Israel. Right. And he called me, I think I was 13. I was still 13, and he called me from Israel, and he wanted to speak to me specifically, which was kind of odd. He's like, let me talk to my, you know, Frank. So my mom gave me the phone. He's like, I found God. You know, I'm like, great, because I didn't have any specific relationship to any particular doctrine. I just remember being, as a kid, always kind of believing and praying kind of before I was going to sleep, or sometimes during stressful moments. And I'd pray for my brother, you know, because when you're a child, you're worried, oh, if he doesn't believe in God, like what's going to happen afterwards? And like, whatever. So it was a great relief to me that he told me that. But, you know, I didn't believe it immediately. At first, I thought he was just messing with me, because, mm-hmm. you know, that's what he, you know, that wouldn't be shocking if you just try to mess with me. But it turned out that he was very serious about it. And that was like a huge, I think it was a huge blessing. And it felt amazing. I felt a great sense of relief on his behalf. So yeah.
Please continue. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's basically how I think he, you know, how, where it happened, or how it happened when he was exposed to, his exposure was to Orthodox Jews in Jerusalem. He met a rabbi. He visited with the family. He spent a Sabbath in the old city of Jerusalem with his family, and he was greatly inspired by them.
So. The your brother had two life-changing experiences happen to him in a period of about 24 months, roughly. One in 2018, when he was given his cancer diagnosis, and then, of course, the one that everyone's familiar with the onset of the pandemic. And I thought it might be interesting for people to hear what was Zev like before the cancer, and then what was Zev like before the pandemic? Because the answer might not be exactly the same. I actually spent all that time writing the book with him, and it's a question I never asked him. So I feel like I'm a bad writer, but I'm asking.
I read the book. I, you know, somehow I feel like perhaps indirectly, I guess, you know, that there was a sense of that communicated, but I'll answer your question to the best of my ability. So he, I think his only, I'm not going to say fear, but his only pain, I suppose, you know, if you, when you boil it down, is, you know, about being, or feeling separated from his children, if he were to go to the next world. And if he had any personal fear about that happening, you know, for just in terms of himself, like what it would be like to, you know, to go to the next world, he didn't really communicate it. He also, you know, he wasn't like in a hurry to do it either, but he was very open to whatever, you know, to whatever God's will was. And when the pandemic came around, it became even more so. And to him, it became even more clear, perhaps why God had put him in that position with that diagnosis right before the pandemic came, because it helped. He thinks it helped him make the decisions that he made that some other people who perhaps weren't looking, you know, towards the same future would make. For instance, like, you know, since he felt that he might very likely be going to the next world, as I say, so he wasn't as concerned for his own welfare, and therefore took certain steps that perhaps other people would be more cautious to take. There's one, for me, like, just, I can only tell you about my personal interactions and what I witnessed.
Well, that's what we're looking for.
Yeah. So he actually called me in March of 2020, and he told me about the progress that he was having with his patients, with his personal patients, and how he was going about treating them. And just to remind people, there was no recommended treatment at all. This is when the pandemic hit America, and the largest outbreak, I've heard people argue this, but it would seem, as far until I see different, that the largest outbreak that was happening in the country was happening right in his area, like you know. So, and he lived in a community, or he was the primary doctor for a community that had 35,000 people living in about a square mile, give or take a tiny bit. The point is, of a lot of people, small area. So, and they were saying, and I still think it's true, that COVID is the most, it was most easy to catch virus, transmissible of any virus in recorded history. I've heard statements like that from people that I respect. So it was, you know, very easy to catch.
Right.
So it spread like, you know, basically like a wildfire, unfortunately. And so because there was no recommended treatment, he he was very close with his community, and he cared very much about the people, and he couldn't just sit idly by. So he was like just obsessively, you know, searching through the medical literature, through that, you know, just to see what can be done, anything. So he looked at what happened in China in prior months, and in Korea, and in France. And each one had, you know, I can't remember which country did which, but one of the countries tried zinc, the other country was working with hydroxychloroquine, and the other country had some success with azithromycin, the antibiotic. Okay, and so he just put it all together because he looked at the, you know, what's the risk of these medications? Very low, because they're very safe drugs, and they've been around forever, and they're ubiquitous. Right? We have decades of data of people taking it daily, sometimes mostly weekly, in malaria zones. And so even if it didn't work, it wouldn't cause any harm. So he did it, and it started working amazingly. Right. And his patients would be alive, meaning we're talking about the high risk individuals, right, that were being told to go home, get sicker, then come to the hospital, get put on a ventilator and die. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's what was happening to everybody else, but not my brother's patients, thank God. So then he had asked me, we had this conversation, what should I do? Should I, I was thinking about, you know, really blowing this up and letting, you know, I want to let everybody know about this. And his reservations were that, you know, he's a conventional doctor, you know, he's not known for, you know, for dipping into, you know, alternative medicine or anything kind of what he would be considered wishy-washy by a conventional doctor. So he was reserved in making an assessment that this actually works, you know, even though he himself saw it initially, how well it was working. He saw the difference between his own patients. He still like was, you know, do I really know? But after 300 patients, after actually a little bit more than that, he's like, no, I have to report what I'm seeing here. This has to be of use to everybody. So he asked me, you know, should he go forward with it? Because I can't get into the whole conversation we had, but there was a fear.
Sure.
There was a fear about going forward with this for various reasons. Okay. So I told him, and he was already of this mindset, but I told him that we should be afraid of not doing it. Because God clearly sent this to him, this information, right? However it got to him, it got to him, right? God can use any means he wants. And it got to my brother, and it's working. And obviously it's meant for the whole world, for every human being to benefit from. And whatever issues we might be worrying, repercussions from political figures or whatnot, okay? Really, it came down to a decision of who are we more afraid of, right? You know, God or a couple of little nothings, right? Mm-hmm. In comparison, obviously, you know?
Right.
God controls everything. Like God won't allow anything that, if God didn't will it, it wouldn't happen. So, you know, politicians or scary people wouldn't be able to do what they want to do unless it was allowed anyway. So point is, who are you going to be more scared of? And so I think he made the right decision and he was going to do that anyway.
Right.
Stop consulting with me. I was just a witness to it. That's all. That he, you know, that's what ultimately caused him to go forward with it. And he was screaming about it as loud as possible and to anybody that would listen from that point on.
All right. We're certainly, the world is glad that he did, because while we know that he was ridiculed for that treatment protocol and had it not just ignored by many, but suppressed by many, many others, including in my household, were treated with it. And everybody who got treated got better. I think the numbers that your brother used were that he had overseen the treatment for about 7,500 patients prior to his death with only 3 fatalities. And that's an extraordinary number. And then when he looked at the risk profile of those patients, the number should have been about 187, as I recall. And so you can start to do the math and extrapolate for the general population, say that over 1 million Americans died from the disease, and then say how many actually needed to if your brother's work had been listened to. Couple minutes left. I want to get your quick take. I know how important Zev's children were to him, and you mentioned his concern about leaving them. Just give everybody a sense of your brother as a father.
He was a very, very loving father. And I think that anybody who has time to spend with the children will see that they're like, although they're much better kids than me and my brother were growing up. Like, they're amazing. Right. They're like, you know, they're very good children. They all have beautiful hearts and they all have a good, you know, a moral compass. And just, no, it's like those children are like a miracle. So thank God for that. And I think he had something to do with it. You know, I just wanted to add a little something about the treatment protocol. Somebody had brought it to my attention. See, I was actually working for my brother during the time. I'll make it very quick. My job was to get everybody their prescriptions once he had the consultation with them. So basically I was buried, you know, under a rock almost 24 hours a day for a couple of years. I didn't get a chance to see all of his interviews during that time. Mm-hmm. And somebody had sent me an interview, not an interview, but a clip of him. It's only 2 minutes long where he was explaining, it was called a biology lesson from Dr. Zelenko. I'll try to get you to put a link to it, where he says that there's a commonality among the Marburg, the Hanta, RSV, the influenza, and the various COVID variants. That, you know, these viruses all kind of function or can be put into the same group in the sense of how they replicate themselves. And he thinks that, he explains that the same treatment that he used for treating COVID is very likely to be very effective. Well, we know that it's effective towards influenza and RSV. That had already kind of been established, but with the other ones as well. So it's very, very high reward to a low risk ratio.
Right. I have to interrupt on that point because we're almost out of time.
Yeah.
10 seconds, a final thing you want somebody to remember about your brother.
That he wanted to save every possible human life as possible. He was screaming as hard as possible. And I want to continue to magnify what he was trying to accomplish by letting people know this basic information. That's, I think, the most important thing to communicate.
Thank you so much. Frank Zelenko, everybody, the brother of Zev Zelenko, for whom the foundation is named and for whom this show is named. We'll be right back with Naomi Wolf.
Thank you.
Freedom of speech is a basic human right that has been hard-won and granted to all law-abiding Americans. As such, we should not take our freedom of speech and expression for granted. This is more important now than ever before, since world governments and the mainstream media often try to suppress those whose opinions differ from the so-called official narrative. Here at RightEonStore.com, we are dedicated to fighting for every American's right to speak their mind without the fear of censorship or suppression. That's why every purchase you make at RightEonStore.com supports our pro-liberty video sharing platform, RightEon.com, so we can keep bringing you all the latest unrestricted videos mainstream media doesn't want you to see. Support your health and this free speech platform by shopping at RightEonStore.com today. With so much of the world's current food supply consisting of dirty, contaminated, genetically modified foods that may have been grown using herbicides and pesticides, increased scrutiny over what you put in your body is of the utmost importance. Even supposedly organic foods found on most grocery store shelves may contain toxic substances, chemicals, and other additives that can be harmful to your health. That's why here at RightEonStore.com, we subject all our in-house products to extensive lab testing for glyphosate, heavy metals, and microbiology using our state-of-the-art spectrometry equipment to ensure the highest quality of cleanliness and purity. Support your health and this free speech platform by shopping at RightEonStore.com today.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Zelenko Report. I am your host, Brent Hamacek. And of course, it's Thursday, and that means we're talking about issues that involve and impact young people. And we do that because the Zelenko Foundation sponsors the Common Ground Campus Program, which is designed to travel around the country to high school and college campuses and make students sit down and engage each other on divisive issues, not to debate them, but to try to find, well, to try to find common ground. And if ever there was a common ground sort of expert in her own right, it is Naomi Wolf, who joins me today. Naomi has been a national thought leader for over 30 years, well-known to the world. And what I admire so much about her is her independent and critical thinking skills. She's not a partisan, she's a thinker. And I think that's a wonderful attribute. She is on some level a role model for me. It makes me want to bring out my own better angels when I think about the work that she has done. So Naomi Wolf, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Mr. Hamacek.
Nobody's ever called me Mr. Hamacek before who wasn't writing me a ticket. So that's
Thank you, Brent, for having me. That's wonderful.
That's wonderful. So Naomi, for those people who have been in a salt mine for 30 plus years and aren't familiar with you, just give the audience the quick Naomi Wolf background, and then we'll jump into the matters at hand.
Sure. So I am a nonfiction writer. I usually write about women's issues or civil liberties, and I've written 8 bestsellers. I co-founded something called the Woodhull Institute for Ethical Leadership, which taught young women about leadership skills. And more recently, I co-founded dailycloud.io, which makes civic engagement easier and more fun. And we have a site called Daily Clout. And there you can send state or federal bill through social media and kind of lobby for anything you care about, write about anything you care about. And I guess right now I'm focused on that and Liberty House, where we're going to bring together leaders from across the political spectrum to kind of reinvent American institutions, because they are so so corrupt right now. They all have to be rebuilt.
Corrupt, such a kind term. You know, you think about the power of the word corrupt, and then you think that in this day and age, that almost doesn't do it, but it's the word we've got. So we got to know you a little bit in part by talking to you about the Common Ground program, and that introduced us to the Liberty House concept that you've developed. And so speak to the Liberty House idea and what it is you're trying to put together on a ranch in New York.
Thank you. Yeah. So, well, I was very influenced by my 10 years running retreats at the Woodhull Institute, because I really saw that when you take young women from all different backgrounds and intensively train them in empowerment skills and critical thinking skills, but also give them each other, because that's the great gift, right, for young people is community and one another, and a place that is intellectually supportive and emotionally supportive in which to grow and develop and encounter new ideas and new people, that really made a measurable difference in how those young women achieved their dreams, and in a way that was really good for the rest of their networks and their communities, because we stressed ethical leadership skills. So it wasn't just, we're going to empower you, you can be awful, but we're going to empower you, and we expect you to use those talents and skill sets in an ethical way for the greater good. So I always knew I'd have another retreat center someday. I parted ways with the leadership of that one after a decade, but you know, after searching for 6 months, we found this beautiful property about 10 minutes outside of the town of Hudson, New York. And so it's about 2 hours and a little bit from New York City, about 3 hours and a little bit from Boston. And I'm in the process of asking for a zoning variance so that we can start running retreats, not just for young women, obviously, for young leaders of any, you know, of either gender, and also importantly from any political background, any ideological background, because well, many reasons, but one of them is, as you found with Common Ground, you know, discourse is so polarized, and universities are no longer intellectually admirable places that support critical thinking and freedom of speech and open debate. So I want to run a ton of programming for young people where those values of, you know, the liberal arts tradition, the humanities tradition, the Western tradition, critical thinking, open discussion, bipartisan exchange of ideas, classical analysis, as well as skill sets like nonfiction writing, basic timelines of history, what is the Constitution, all of those things can be taught.
So one of the, our foundation's founder, Dr. Zelenko, one of his biggest complaints, and it's brought up in the book that I had the chance to co-author with him, is how our universities are no longer teaching critical thinking skills. And his focus on it was, of course, in the world of medicine, where he felt mm-hmm. that doctors were coming out of school driven instead of by critical thought, driven instead by algorithms and what mm-hmm. those things could decide for them.
Wow.
But on a broader level, and going back to that critical thinking piece, what are you finding when you're engaging with young people today? what do you see in them that's missing and needs to be brought out? Or what do you see that's might be in them that almost needs to be broken down and gotten rid of? In other words, what are the things that aren't there and what are the bad habits that might exist at the same time?
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's so hard to generalize, right? Because these poor kids have had 2.5 years of their lives basically excised out of their personal histories by being sent home from college. And, you know, even now after people are technically able to be back at school or back in the workplace, the habits of civilized congregation have decayed. So one thing I'm really noticing is, you know, young adults in their early 20s no longer, they're more comfortable encountering each other on their devices than they are. They've lost the habits of being in auditoriums, being in theaters, being in town halls, being in protests, you know, being in civic spaces or commercial spaces together or spiritual spaces together. They've just lost the habit. I mean, something really heartbreaking was said to me by a young thought leader who came to Liberty House and spent, you know, 3 days with people of all ages who are thought leaders, because I'm, you know, informally running those weekends. And he said, wow, it's so different to be with people for 3 days. You know, I know all these people digitally. I know them. I interact with them in cyberspace, but it's so different and wonderful to be physically present with them. And he didn't say it like, oh yeah, usually we're physically present. Otherwise I, you know, see these people online. It was more like he never had that experience of being deeply engaged with other humans in human space, sharing ideas for long periods of time. And, you know, even on college campuses, there's so much distance, right? There's so much remote learning still. There's so much digital experience, even in the library. You know, kids just, they don't, I mean, it's really notable. When I was an undergraduate, on a nice day, we were all lying on cross campus at Yale in the sun, you know, talking and flirting and playing Frisbee, and we were out together. And now no one lies on the grass anymore on a sunny day, right? Because why would you? You know, why would you lie on the grass with a book, right? Because that's not a thing people do. So those are just some examples, but it's the digital world, and I address this in my book, The Bodies of Others, intentionally gave these kids so many entertaining, diverting things to do digitally and broke down the ease of use of their common spaces in order to, you know, rehabituate them. And I guess the other thing that makes me sad is, you know, being a young adult is stressful, you know, socially. Like, you're learning how to be human with other human beings and build relationships, and it can be embarrassing, or you can have rejection or not know what to say. So what I am sad about is seeing how the devices come out whenever there's a moment of social anxiety. And, you know, I did feel quite wonderful at Liberty House, where I, you know, I asked people not to use their devices in the common spaces. And that can sound quite draconian. And I think everyone had a little bit of withdrawal over the weekend. But by, you know, midway through, the richness of the human interaction is just so much more intense, because not only is everyone's focus together, but that option of, this is a tricky moment, I'm just going to check out by consulting my phone, isn't there. So people navigate and learn, you know, learn to sail through it, or find a new way to connect, or even have a tough moment and think, wow, I've learned from that. I'll store that in my arsenal of how humans communicate or don't communicate. Right. So there's obviously the technology fraying them. At the same time, I think this is a very compassionate generation. I think they have, you know, it's very easy to make fun of wokeness. And I do come from the left, so, you know, that's my bias. And I'm up with the left, as you know, right now. But, you know, because for sure, wokeness on campus has gone too far, right? But there is like a middle ground, in the sense that this generation isn't racist by and large. They're not homophobic by and large. They're not xenophobic by and large, right? You can certainly say, and it's true, that they're too scared to ask hard questions about these areas, for sure. But at the same time, it is a less emotionally brutal generation, right? I mean, I went to Yale at a time when date rape was common, you know, rape wasn't taken seriously, women were silenced in classes, there was unconscious racism right, left, and center, and anti-Semitism. And so I do think these young adults, if they can be encouraged to think critically about nonsense related to race, class, and gender, that will be wonderful. But something lovely is that they are, you know, well-intentioned and inclusive and decent, I feel, overwhelmingly. What is the last thing I would say about, well, I guess, and then following up on that, notably, they're scared, right? Because their universities have brutalized them. And I think we're going to only see the results of this or the impact over the years and decades ahead. But I think they will never get over the trauma of being isolated for 2 years, let alone the trauma of only being allowed back if they allowed a damaging or deadly substance into their bodies. And that is like literally the definition of physical trauma, physically traumatic experiences. I think it's scarred them. And I also realize that at least at Yale, I haven't checked with other universities, there's such a surveillance apparatus, like, you know, you can't get in unless you show your cards. If you're late for your COVID check-in, that, you know, you get switched off of access to, you know, certain programs. The health, you know, the health department, you know, sends you a text if you haven't, you know, swabbed or whatever. And I think that they're habituated to surveillance in a way that has really made them scared. And the last thing I'll say is I was at Hillsdale College a couple of days ago speaking, and it felt like America again. That's a very conservative college that never shut down, a Christian college, and it's attracting, you know, Martin Kulldorff and Jay Bhattacharya and all these dissidents. But the kids there were asking open questions about things like the corruption of the medical establishment, and their readiness to ask open questions really contrasted with the sense of inhibition and fear that I feel from other students on campus.
You covered so much ground there, and it was brilliantly covered and triggered a lot of interesting thoughts for me, because I think probably I looked like a bobblehead doll while you were speaking because I kept nodding my head up and down. I think at least I was in my mind if I wasn't doing it physically. Let's talk a little bit about the social media piece, because it's interesting. And one of the most interesting things you said, by the way, was talking about how these young people are more open-minded now. It actually is something that, in the context in which you brought it up, I hadn't thought about it. But things like race and homosexuality and other things that were so divisive, say, in our youth, now they're really not, right? And yet, it's interesting, we've still found a way to be divided. So right. It's almost like it's like life on Jurassic Park. It finds a way, division finds a way. Part of that in my mind is the social media piece. One of the things we say as kind of a tagline within Common Ground is that we're trying to get rid of and attack the notion of hate in the third person, because it's very easy to hate the theys and thems. And so what we're doing when we have students on stage across from each other is they're in three dimensions. They're right. You're looking them dead in the eye. And then it gets much, much more difficult to hate and use that kind of language, because now it's a real human being sitting across from you. And in this digital world, I have a daughter in her early 20s. I mean, I've watched over the last decade, because she's grown up with social media. I mean, people even break up with each other over text messages. I mean, what used to be the most painful personal thing to do in the world, sitting down with someone and saying, you know, our relationship is over, now they do it by punching it into their iPhone. And it's fascinating to me, right? Yeah. So what is it that we need to combat with regard to social media when we're trying to bring students together and get them to think critically and honestly and openly? And so what do we have to fight? And then what do we also have to use? Because it's like everything else. You can either use a butcher knife to cut a piece of beautiful meat and cook it, or you can use it to take out your partner. So there's multiple uses for the same thing. And what a horrible metaphor I just created. So how do we fight it and how do we use it?
Such an important question. Well, I, you know, as I mentioned, I am a big believer in device-free spaces and times. You know, I was very upset when I realized in my kids' school, they were starting to give iPads to kindergartners and first graders. And this was a, you know, an expensive private school. Not that that was my choice, but that's where my kids went, because I knew that that would create kids who could not do without iPads, and who didn't, you know, who had trouble focusing on books, and that's so predictable. And I guess as educators, I do think it's very important to, you know, have policies where kids put their devices in their lockers at the beginning of the day, or in, I mean, literally lock boxes. I would do that. I would have like secure lock boxes. You check them in, you don't get them till, you know, till the end of the day when you leave, so that students have an experience of not being able to check out in the way that their phones allow them to do. And, you know, certainly parents, I mean, this is such an ongoing fight, right, for my kids' generation, even more for my stepson, who's 11, and his generation. But I do think parents have to take the devices away or turn on the timers. I see so much ADD. I have ADD. You know, I know from personal experience how much worse it is when I'm exposed to a lot of distractions digitally, how much more difficult it is to enter that kind of beta or theta brainwave state in which all real creative work with sustained focus takes place. So it kind of makes me angry because this isn't rocket science, right? You know, brain, like my uncle Dan Goleman wrote, you know, important books about emotional intelligence and focus. And we've known for like 20 years now that the brain has to do certain things in order to sustain focus, and that digital interruption, you know, is the opposite of the kind of thinking you need in order to write a book or produce a play or have a heartfelt conversation with someone that is emotionally meaningful. So I would be draconian about that, even though kids kick and scream. You have to. You're literally preserving neural pathways in the brain by not letting them have access to their devices, you know, except for limited periods of time. And I guess in terms of when they're adults, young adults, thinking of a program, for instance, at Liberty House or your Common Ground program, you know, I would definitely have policies where, you know, here's leave your phone, or leave your phone in your bag while we have this experience for the next 2 hours. And apart from that, I would say it's up to us as adults. And again, this is why universities have so much to answer for allowing lockdown and, you know, embracing the profits of remote learning. But if we make IRL experiences so engaging to them, they're not going to reach for their phones. I was so struck at Hillsdale, you know, this one place where they're still teaching critical thinking, classical education, and there is a fair amount of structure socially. You know, it's not everything goes. It's kind of like moral expectations, character expectations. The kids were not on their phones voluntarily because they were having a rich, meaningful experience. And, you know, and lastly, again, look at the trauma, right? We, you know, kids on campuses that mandate vaccines or that shut down, they're on campuses where the adults have shown that they will brutalize and injure the young adults who are, for whom they are in loco parentis, meaning in the role of parents, you right. know, especially for minors. And the pain of that emotionally would lead a young adult, or these kids are teenagers and they go to college, you know, 17, 18, 19, that would lead you to want to check out, numb yourself, whether it's cannabis or, you know, prescription drugs or the phone. And so it's up to us to create institutions for them in which they actually are safe. I don't mean safe from ideas, but safe from adults harming them or putting them in danger.
So we have just about a minute left. I want you to give it one short little soundbite piece of advice. I mentioned your intellectual integrity at the beginning of the show, and that's what drew me to you. But what really drew me to you even more so was your courage, because during the pandemic, you were willing to break orthodoxy and use your critical thinking and stand up for what you thought was right. So in a short soundbite, give somebody something that they can take with them on how to find the courage to be willing to stand up and say what they believe is right, because Naomi Wolf certainly embraces that.
Thank you. Well, I guess to me, you know, we really don't have a choice. And that's why I really advocate that people study history. You know, think about the worst thing that will happen to you if you stand up and speak your truth. At this point, you're not going to be dragged off to a basement, you know, by Gestapo and beaten or locked in a prison cell. But the only way to stop that from happening is to stand up and tell your truth. So I would just have people ask, what's the worst thing that will happen to me if I tell the truth? And then if I keep silent, for sure, worse things will happen.
Beautiful. I love it. Naomi Wolf, everybody. It's been a pleasure and a privilege to have you on. I hope you'll come back because there's so much more to talk about. It's the fastest 22 minutes in television. So thank you so much for being a guest today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. And if I may, we have a new book out, The War Room Daily Club, Pfizer Documents Reports on Amazon. And I do encourage people to take a look at it, to use their critical thinking to find out what's really, what the FDA tried to hide, what Pfizer tried to hide.
And we will promote that book on the show and in the shared links. And I encourage everyone to buy everything that Naomi Wolf has written.
Thank you so much, Brent.
You bet. Thanks for coming. We'll be right back.
Take care.